Welcome to Wrap'em Focus, a podcast devoted to exploring the provocative and impactful aspects of the research published in Regional Anesthesia and Pain Medicine. Here, we'll make sure to discuss and debate the findings that matter most for clinicians, patients, and policymakers. I'm Brian Seitz, Editor-in-Chief. I am an anesthesiologist and professor at Dartmouth Hitchcock Medical Center. At Wrap'em, we believe well-done pain medicine improves health and well-being. I'll work to keep the discussion relevant and factual. Thanks for joining us. Let's get started. The global use of cannabinoids for both recreational and medicinal purposes is accelerating at a remarkable pace. By 2026, the cannabinoid market capitalization is predicted to be approximately $97 billion, which will far surpass that of the largest pharmaceutical company in the world. Political, professional, and cultural conflict has emerged centered around the impact, good or bad, on the health and well-being of our society already suffering from epidemic levels of drug-related morbidity. So what do you think, Wrap'em community? You've got a mix of big money, passion, hope, science, patience, pain, suffering, advocacy, and politics. What could possibly go wrong? This is why I'm so very excited that Azra Payne commissioned a cannabis working group to create a perioperative guideline to help physicians understand potential health implications for patients having surgery who are using cannabis products. Today, we're joined by Shalini Shah and Hans Clark. Shalini Shah is a professor and vice chair for the Department of Anesthesiology and Perioperative Services at the University of California, Irvine. Dr. Shah completed her residency in anesthesiology from Cornell University and a combined fellowship in adult and pediatric chronic pain at Harvard Medical School. Hans Clark is the director of pain services in the pain research unit at Toronto General Hospital in Canada. He is the knowledge translation chair for the University of Toronto Center for the Study of Pain and associate professor in the Department of Anesthesiology in Pain Medicine at the University of Toronto. Thanks so much to both of you for joining us.
Our pleasure.
Thanks so much, Brian. Pleasure to be here.
All right. Well, to start things off, can you tell us a little bit about how you got the idea for the project? So like what I'm getting at is in the myriad of options for the resources of Azra Payne to be invested in, why this topic?
About 2 years ago, actually one of my colleagues here at UC Irvine started the special interest group of cannabis for Azra. And so a lot of ideas were floating around in terms of what can this SIG do. And one of the ideas that came out from that SIG, which is really fun when an idea comes out from a very, just an interest group really, is how can we better educate both our anesthesia and pain colleagues about the implications of cannabis. And that's when Dr. Nehru's said, well, why don't we create a practice advisory guidelines around it? And that's really how it started.
And what about you, Hans? How did you think of this or get involved?
I mean, I think we were pushed a little faster in Canada. And so, you know, when you look at the use of cannabis in Canada, we had a recreational market in 2018 that was legal. And it was, you know, nationally accessible to patients from 2014. We had kind of created a working group in Canada. And so it was nice to be invited by Shalini and her group into these new guidelines. And so we have our own guidelines that were a little bit more rudimentary. They were much earlier than these. And I think these have built on our guidelines quite well.
Well, I'm really glad that this project came to fruition and generated a wonderful manuscript that I think will be cited very highly, which is great for our society and for our journal. And the reason why I'm personally so excited about it, and I'm curious to get your thoughts on this, is that there's so little information to really guide physicians, especially in the perioperative sense or on acute pain medicine in their consulting work around this topic. And in the United States, and I can't really speak to Canada, most of the dispensaries are really not, you know, I would say none of the dispensaries are actually hooked up with healthcare systems. And so there's really a gap in how you transition somebody or support someone from a health sciences standpoint to these dispensaries that are often run for profit or not, you know, necessarily set up specifically for medicinal reasons. And so the more information to help physicians understand these products and guide them is really is really interesting to me. I'm just kind of curious to get your thoughts.
Yeah, I'll tell you, here in the United States, exactly what you said. You know, the quality control varies from state to state, as does the regulation, whether recreational is approved, medicinal is approved, and whether you're or a physician's providing a recommendation versus a prescription. And by the way, when we provide recommendations, there is no guarantee of product. So unlike a prescription, a recommendation could be for CBD topical, but the patient could leave a dispensary with THC as, you know, a smoked product. So there's a lot of quality control issues that go along with cannabis here in the U.S. that maybe other countries, and I'm interested to hear what Hans has to say, may not be an issue in other countries. And so given that fact, and the amount of almost fad there is behind cannabis, it was really imperative for us to put some guidelines or some documentation behind it and really have everyone speak in the same language. What is terminology? What is the pharmacology? What are the clinical implications with cannabinoid therapy?
Yeah, and if I can just lead into what Shalini just said, you know, we do have a little bit better control here because we are the ones who authorize it, and we are the ones who know the template. So we have a major, pharmacy chain here at the moment that actually does some regulation and testing on many of these products. So we've kind of overcome some of the hurdles of not knowing that what we're authorizing is what the patient will get. And so we fixed that a little bit. But I'm bang on in agreeing with Shalini in terms of the regulatory piece. And so, you know, if you want to compare what patients are consuming, and there's a bit of a working group here and with a little bit of the folks south of the border as well, looking at what is a product and what's in the market. And so from a regulatory standpoint, the tobacco industry has higher regulatory standards than the cannabis industry does right now. And that should tell you that we do have to be quite careful in terms of knowing what a patient's consuming, how much they're consuming, and what the terminology is that we're going to use to figure out what we do from a care standpoint.
Those are great points. And I remember about a month ago, I do a lot of acute pain medicine, and we had a patient that was interested in starting medicinal use of cannabinoids for chronic pain. And she was an inpatient. She was getting transitioned to you know, outpatient status, and everyone was looking to the acute pain medicine service to make us recommendations about how to do this. And I went to look at the online description of the products available at the local dispensary where she would actually be likely going to. And it was like I was looking at a sushi menu or something. It was like, you know, like it was like, you know, blue crust special or things like that. And I was like, this doesn't feel right. I mean, I don't know how to, really get a handle of this from a scientific standpoint. So do you see what I'm saying?
Totally. It's a bit of a shock factor for sure. And what I would say is none of that really matters to us, right? All we need to know is what the concentration of the products are that people are using and what's the milligrams per mil if they're consuming oils and what's the milligram. And they do it in a weird way, milligrams per gram if it's a plant-based product. And that will give you, you know, the potential of how much that receptor sees and whether the patient's inhaling or consuming orally, that changes the PK and things like that as well.
And we're going to just spend a little bit of time here talking about maybe, a little bit of the politics around guidelines. But for the readers of the journal and the listeners to the podcast, can you help differentiate? It's not easy. The technical aspects of a guideline versus a practice advisory, because we've had both come out over the last, 10 years or so in RAPM. Sponsored by now Azra Payne. So just curious if you can kind of, if that came up in your working group to make that distinction.
Hans, I don't think it came up. Do you recall any conversation about that?
No, I don't. And it's interesting. It's sometimes at the journal that kind of decides whether we can call it a guideline or call it a consensus statement or call it a practice advisory. And so, I mean, as long as we're looking for evidence and we're trying to grade evidence, I think we fall in the land of guideline. The issue is when the evidence isn't great, as it isn't in the cannabis space, that's when you get a lot of criticism to say, well, show me how this is a guideline unless you can back it by RCT evidence. And we don't have the RCT evidence in this space. And so I think it was fortunate that RAPM, and I think, Brian, you might have had something to do with that, called this a guideline because, we weren't allowed to call ours in Canada a guideline just 3 years earlier. It was called a consensus statement.
Yeah, and it's a little bit of a kind of a controversial area. And I think it's fair to say that the board, at least the Azra board, believes that guidelines or a framework or a roadmap to guide physicians where you know we can address certain questions and actually grade the evidence, whereas a practice advisory is more like addressing a specific clinical issue and providing best practice recommendations. But it is a little bit of fine definition, and I think you know the concern that some readers have and some members have is that these kind of documents might end up being kind of legal issues, and so that kind of like leads into my next question is that I think there's two categories of maybe it's not this binary, but I kind of over the question I'm going to make it binary. There's two camps. Camp one is very supportive and appreciative of the efforts of thoughtful people to help clarify medical decision making in the setting of imperfect and incomplete science, which this certainly is. And I'd say the other camp can be quite negative about them because, basically they make an argument that, guidelines may become fodder for lawyers and often do not actually help real world decision making. And I don't know if this came up in the whole process or group dynamics, but it would be just kind of fun to hear if it was a consideration.
It absolutely was. And so just to be very clear, the guidelines, whether it's these cannabis guidelines or whether it's the CDC guidelines, I don't think any guidelines are intended to limit or deny care, right? Or affect the rights of patients or define standard of care. That's not the intent. The real intent of these guidelines were to improve surgical outcomes in patients. Okay. And the reason I bring that up is because we don't want to, in pursuing good science and recommendations, we don't want to stigmatize patients. And that's what we learned from the opiate guidelines and the CDC guidelines, that all of a sudden we may be stigmatizing those patients who legitimately do need their pain medications. And so in that process and in that vein, we decided to include a patient advocate on our panel, on the expert panel, who is also a lawyer. And that was a really great decision, again, as a suggestion by Dr. Nehruz, that I really feel that really framed the document in terms of making sure that the patients are heard and they're not stigmatized.
Go back to the question of the two camps. And so, I'm sure Shalini has presented these guidelines multiple times now, and you see the two camps at the end of those presentations, right? The ones that are very helpful for some guidelines to deal with these issues that they are, kind of struggling with. What do we do? Do we delay this case? Do we put these patients off to sleep? Do we have enough information about what they're doing and how this could interact with what we're doing? And then you have the other camp that's like, there's just this, all this stigma, the stigma they brought to it. Why, what does this mean? We don't even know what you're saying makes any sense. So we shouldn't actually be creating guidelines about this. And so the fact is you want to just treat the patients and meet them where they're at. And I think the only way you meet people where they're at is by understanding what they're consuming. And this has been accepted by society. Cannabis is now part of our society. So we have to have a framework in which we can actually meet these people and say, okay, we get you're using this. We are giving you, we're taking you to, quote unquote, a place where you definitely want to come back from. And so if that's going to happen, we need to know as much as we can, continue to collect data about this stuff. And you have to be truthful with us. And that's one of the things you always meet resistance with. Well, why are we asking people these questions? Listen, people using cannabis want to tell you what they're using. They want to tell you, whether it's THC or CBD or a 1-to-1 ratio. And in Canada, we're lucky where it's completely legal. I mean, the thing the U.S. has is you still have states where it's not legal and some that are semi-legal and all of these kind of issues. And so when you can collect data and get your patients to talk to you, it's always an opportunity to do that. And so, I fall in camp one, obviously.
That's a fantastic insight. And I remember having this back and forth with Eric Schwenk, who is a co-author with you at Jefferson. And we were talking about, and I know we're going to get to this a little bit later in the podcast, but the recommendation regarding potentially delaying surgery, which is an absolutely potential powder keg, right? And so I said, "Are you guys sure you really want to put this in there?" and we went back and forth a couple times, and he representing the group felt really strongly, and that kind of leads into I think the next question around grading the evidence, if you will. And you used a grading system for evidence and then converted that to suggestions for practice, which I thought was pretty cool. You also used something called level of certainty. I was wondering if you could summarize these techniques and tools so that the readers understand how you came to the decisions that you did. And I think this is important because it'll give everyone a sense that this process was extensive.
Yes. So the methodology was using a grading criteria by the USPSTF's, which is a US Preventative Task Force rating, which is similar to most guidelines, actually. You have a grading methodology of A, B, C, D, and I, and that correlates to what you can offer for suggestions for practice. So grade A, obviously, we recommend that we offer or provide the service, versus grade I says, if the service is offered, patients should understand the uncertainty about the balance of benefits and harms. And that then correlates with the level of certainty that you mentioned, Brian. So whenever we made the grading, we always tried to correlate it with the level of certainty. So if I make a level of grading of A saying, yes, we should do this, well, then what is my level of certainty behind it? If it's a high level of certainty, well, then that basically tells the reader that there is, you know, we're using consistent results from well-designed, well-conducted studies, right, in the representative populations, versus if we used a low level of certainty, which quite honestly, unfortunately, that is the challenge with the a lot of the studies that we found is that there is an absence, as Dr. Clark mentioned, of RCT data. So a lot of these, while they're big sample size data sets, it's really not level one evidence. So certainty sometimes is low, right? So a lot of it is dependent on what the patient reports. Oh, I use cannabis once a day. Oh, I think I use this. Oh, sometimes I use this. Or, you know, so that's where the limitation lies in some of the studies and definitely was reflected in the grading.
And I would just add that that's one of the reasons why the guidelines are important is because if there was, you know, 1,000 RCTs on every topic, we'd have the systematic review meta-analyses that definitively answers the question. So it's not surprising to me that you found the levels of evidence that you did, because that in essence was the impetus to do the project.
And, you know, just touching on the delay of surgery, I think the only place we suggest that is acute intoxication, right, Brian? And so
right.
If someone's acutely intoxicated, that would be the case. We're talking about a potential delay because someone's using cannabis. And so we don't want this to get to the place, well, if you use cannabis, you delay surgery. That really doesn't make a lot of sense, especially for the people using it for a health-related condition, right, that are using it daily or are using this as part of their regimen.
Yeah, and I think maybe this is a good segue into some of the kind of the main recommendations from the manuscript. And I know there's a lot there. So I'm open to having you two kind of pick a couple things that you think you want to highlight. And I would mention that there's a wonderful infographic that comes with this manuscript that I think helps kind of go through all this material. And I encourage people to kind of actually print that out and even hang it in your offices and give it to the residents. But to start this discussion about the acute intoxication issue, it came up to me already. What's the definition of acute intoxication? One of the areas that I run into a lot in the ambulatory arena, in particular, is because so many people, to your point, Dr. Clark, use this already. They're self-medicating because surgery is an anxiety provoking time period, and so they'll often, you know, use the product, let's say, on the way to the hospital. Now, they may not appear, you know, especially a chronic user, acutely intoxicated, like someone, at happy hour, late on a Super Bowl weekend. But so the question is, what does it mean? They have blood levels. Is that acute intoxication? You know?
Yeah, I mean, I don't think there's a clear answer to that one, Brian. Right. So if we think about what acute intoxication, we need some behavioral scale for that, and we don't have that, right? So this is where it comes down to your clinical acumen as well. And so, you know, someone that is a chronic cannabis user that potentially inhales on the morning of surgery, you have to kind of make a behavioral call. Are they acutely intoxicated or not? I mean, the funny thing about this is what is cannabis? It's a CNS depressant, okay? It is the same as a benzodiazepine. It is the same as, you know, high-dose opioids. And let's think about if we dig down to the molecular mechanisms, we know where these drugs act. They act on the CB1 receptors. They act on the overall downregulation of your receptors. So what is a behavioral measure that would say that someone is acutely intoxicated? I'm not quite sure. I mean, they're going to look like your benzo patient that has consumed a good dose of your midazolam that you gave him as a pre-medication.
Right. But there's two separate issues, right? There's an informed consent legal issue, and then there's the physiologic potential negative implications, which you highlight in the paper. And But that wouldn't be an issue with benzodiazepines if you had, let's say, a pre-existing consent because someone was going to be pre-medicated with Ativan, and that's in the books, and you're like, okay, so they come in, they're a little, you know, kind of like sedated, but that's all right. You know, we won't give any midazolam on the way over. But we're not thinking, oh, that's going to, you know, potentially contribute to myocardial ischemia. So is the behavioral scale linked to the potential myocardial ischemia, or isn't it more of a pharmacokinetic issue of a blood level?
Well, if that's the case, we need a ton of data, right? I mean, we really won't have an ability to say, is this, 5 nanograms per mil? Do they have 8 nanograms per mil? We just don't know. And right. I think that's where you really need to understand what's the product the patient consumed. And if they're consuming a high dose 27% THC product and they look really intoxicated, yeah, you might want to wait a little bit, right? The half-life of inhaled cannabis is probably 2 to 4 hours. So they wait a little bit until you feel comfortable that you're not seeing that heart rate high and their blood pressure is going to probably struggle a little bit. And I think that's fair. I think it's clinical judgment.
Which would mean obviously a cancellation in an ambulatory center.
Potentially.
In terms of other major kind of recommendations and findings, do you want to summarize some of them and maybe connect them up to any key pharmacokinetic principles that you think are relevant? Kind of leave it as a kind of open-ended discussion for a little bit.
Yeah. So one of the things that I always start with is understanding the receptor pharmacology of cannabis is extraordinarily complex because the receptor itself is extraordinarily complex. It's probably the receptor that has the highest receptor density in our body. And each varietal can have up to even greater than 120 different phytocannabinoids within that plant species. So you can now understand why we see the biphasic effects that we do. For example, at low doses of THC, it might be an anxiolytic, but at high doses of THC, we see the paranoia, panic attack, psychosis, right? Same thing with emesis. At low doses of THC, it's an antiemetic, but at high doses, it can be a proemetic. And then taking that down to what we see in terms of the periop space, same thing goes with how often the patient is using the cannabis, right, or smoking it. So new users typically display tachycardia, malignant hyperarrhythmias, versus chronic users, typically we're seeing bradycardia, sinus arrest, hyperactive airways, coronary vasospasms, again, leading to this biphasic property of the drug.
And, I think to me, I was kind of caught off guard with some of the negative perspectives that this manuscript brought to light, because so much of what we hear is all these potential wonderful, medicinal effects of the drug, and to kind of see that there was actually some real serious concerns about the morbidity potentially really got my attention. Was this a surprise to you too, or was this kind of what you were expecting?
I think probably Dr. Clark knew that because a lot of the work came from him, his group. Okay. But for the American anesthesiologist, no, I don't think so. For the American anesthesiologist that's at the bedside, I don't think that they knew, and certainly we were all surprised as well. With the higher risk odds ratio of post-op MI, and that risk increases significantly if the patient has smoked cannabis within the first hour of that stressor. So a lot of interesting findings, and really, it's. I'm glad that we did find what we did and we're able to educate our colleagues both on the pain side as well as on the OR side.
And I think, Brian, I'll take a more general kind of look at what I think is my two favorite parts of this. Is one, it really just highlights you have to ask the question now, right? And you need to know what your patients are taking. Cannabis is part of the society, and we need to know what people are taking, what they're taking, how much they're taking, what the constituents in what they're using is. And the fact is, many people sometimes don't even know themselves. And then you can start to really see the problem with this space in general. The second one is on the tail end. So now you have this high consuming cannabis patient that is inhaling, but they're not necessarily here for a day surgery or, you know, and then they're in hospital. And so what happens on that post-op day one or two, and what could you use when you see, you know, I've had patients on my acute pain service literally try to unplug themselves from the wall to go outside and have their joint, right? And they're hooked up to their O2. And we're like, well, that's not really going to happen. You know, you can use some dronabinol, you can use some of these other meds to just dampen down the kind of heightened CNS response it's going to have when the system's not seeing this drug that they've been consuming habitually and daily for years. And I think, you know, those are some really helpful tips for the anesthesiologist, because now you know they're consuming it and what you might expect. And we have a piece on the PACU. We have a piece in terms of a little bit beyond the PACU as well.
Those are both great points from both of you. And I'd also curious to get your thoughts on the pain experience in a habitual user and the nausea risk as well. I believe that you have some thoughts on that probably.
Yeah, you know, what's interesting, and the more I review both animal model studies as well as human studies, is that there's a disconnect in terms of what we see from the animal models to the human models. In the animal models, you see a synergism between opiates and even a potentiation of opioid receptors. Sometimes THC effect in the animal models could reach up to a tenfold potency of morphine. But we just did not see that consistently in human studies. In fact, most of what we found is that pain can actually be exacerbated with the use of cannabis in the acute post-op period, associated with higher pain scores and higher opiate requirements. And then a more recent study showed that cannabis has no for cannabis for pain has no difference than placebo, which is really in complete contrast to what we see marketed or seen on the media, or what patients tell us, quite frankly, that THC and cannabis seems to help their pain. So that was eye-opening for me, at least.
Yeah, and this is what I was getting at before, where I felt like there was a negative trajectory in the perioperative arena that stood in contrast to some of the things we're seeing in the community and in the chronic pain arena. So that caught my attention too. And that's kind of why I was asking the question. And then I was thinking about all the drug interactions that you get in, you mentioned in the paper, which is super helpful and interesting for me personally, because on acute pain medicine service, we need to know about these drug interactions. And the one that really caught my attention was the Coumadin drug interaction. Do either one of you want to just comment on that?
Yeah, you know, Brian, that's a big one. I'll tell you, we've been authorizing cannabis for quite some time, and we have transplant patients, we have our vascular patients, and there's no doubt in particular CBD and even some of the THC products do bump your Coumadin. I've seen people on, you know, their INRs of 8, and they were stable for a long time. We start cannabis in them, and it's something you really do have to keep an eye on, because they're metabolized by the same CYP enzymes, and so of course if you add an add an input, you're going to slow down the conversion of another one, and so you certainly see that with Coumadin. So you have to take some time, be cautious about that one.
Yeah, that's just really, really helpful information. Are there any other important ones you want to highlight? I know there were a lot in the paper.
I mean, I think the big ones, I think Shalini hit the one on the head, because everyone's talking about the synergism between opioids and you know, cannabis products. But in humans, we're really not seeing the similar data to animal studies. That being said, I don't think you're not so concerned if someone's on an opioid, they're potentially not going to be that you're going to have a big issue with cannabis. And in a perioperative setting, we're not seeing them long enough that I think it really matters. You know, other than that, you've got any of your PPIs, things like that. If you're taking an oral product, we'll have a reduced absorption of these products. And beyond that, I think we're still gathering data.
But I think the theme for the perioperative physician is that these are real drugs. And we're learning about them still, and they're going to have drug-drug interactions and potential morbidity and potential therapeutic effect as well. I'm not being completely negative, but it just has to, the whole spectrum has to be considered.
And so, Brian, I'll share a quick story with you. So this past week, I tried to get in our pre-admission unit basically 5 questions added to the nurse practitioner's pre-op grid of questions that we ask. And I was was told to me that patients might refuse to ask cannabis related questions. I said, where are we? Are we still in the 1950s? This is 2022. It's completely legal. And, you know, that camp too is still saying, well, we can't really ask these questions. We have to ask these questions. We need to know, just based on this discussion between the three of us, who's using, what they're using, how much they're using, and what their outcomes look like in the perioperative setting, right? So this is an opportunity for everybody to start collecting this data.
Great point. Now, just to transition quickly, because we're coming to the end here. I alluded to this before when we were talking about the Ativan example, but I'd like to know both of your opinions on the informed consent issue in terms of chronic use of cannabis products. So even if you decide you're going to delay, surgery for someone who, let's say, used the product in the car to treat anxiety, would you consider that still okay, or to get informed consent if you were going to, proceed at some point, or would you just use your kind of behavioral assessment to do that, or is there like, okay, this is a mind altering drug and this is not appropriate to have a discussion about risk benefit with around anesthesia, et cetera?
I can tell you it's not really as much of a hot issue, I think, here as it definitely would be in the US. And, these people have been seen in pre-op, they've consented to their surgery. Yes, they have to sign on the dotted line. Unless someone is completely acutely intoxicated, it's not a big concern for me. I can't say that it's the same for all of my colleagues. But, again, it's clinical decision, clinical gut. If you really think someone is completely impaired in their thought pattern, then you probably do have to delay or cancel them.
Yeah, for me, it boils down to how much do you know? And this is why the first question that we had answered is, making sure you screen patients for use. And some patients will endorse, I just used it in the parking lot, which begs the question, can I now obtain an informed consent, meaning can they reliably understand their risks, their benefits, and their alternatives to undergoing this procedure? And I would argue probably not. When patients have anxiety for an epidural and we provide a benzodiazepine PO, we make sure that they take that after they've signed their informed consent. So I think the same would apply once you know that they have assumed a potentially mind-altering substance, then it's hard to justify from a legal standpoint that you really provided them an informed consent, I feel.
We probably will not solve this dilemma on this podcast, but it's a great thing for the audience to think about, because it's coming soon, if it hasn't already, to your center. Now, I'd like to get your thoughts on continuing education and resources that can help program directors and residents and fellows learn about these drugs. And because you probably discovered in your journey making this manuscript what good resources were and what, say, bad resources were as well. And I'm hoping you're not going to tell me you just typed everything into open chat AI, right?
don't give our secrets out, Brian.
Because there's a lot of people really desiring information on this topic, and what recommendations would you have if they want to explore this in a deeper sense?
I think for me, reviewing literature that is outside of America is probably the best place to start. For me, a lot of guidance came from Hans and Hans's group's work, because they have a more structured ideology and regulation around dose, concentration, things like that, and so that makes a difference. And then. I also say it's great to have the big SMR studies, but just evaluate that data with a grain of salt, because again, the inclusion for high quality RCTs is pretty minimal, right? It's hard to do in this regulatory environment. So those are the two points that I would have. So non-US based studies.
And so Shalini's super kind for saying all of that, but she's now the face of this in the US, and so she's going to be holding the torch south of the border. But what I will tell you, Brian, is that, a bit of a shameless plug, I'm about to be the president of the Canadian Pain Society up north, and I'm on the board of the Canadian Consortium for the Investigation of Cannabinoids, and so that's CCIC. And we have a huge educational program from molecules, basically the stuff that's in the document here, right through to what the important things to consider if you're actually authorizing some of this stuff, down to cannabis use disorder and how you treat all of these things. And so it's a good resource for physicians if they want to educate themselves about cannabis and medical care in general. Beyond that, I agree completely with Shalini. You know, you follow the literature and see how this evolves. We now have RCTs approved. I have an RCT approved at my site. There's about three or four others in Canada because we have that national infrastructure that we can, you know, do multi-site trials and GMP-based products. So we're talking placebo-controlled trials that should be coming out in the years ahead.
Okay, so now it's clear to me and to everyone probably that more work is needed to better understand the relationship between cannabis and cannabinoid products and health outcomes. What do you see as the next best steps from a both, let's say, a clinical perspective and a research perspective?
In the U.S., I think, look, the industry, as you Mark, you mentioned earlier, is just going to explode. And along with the cannabis industry comes a lot of subsidiaries of other companies that are spinoffs. And for us, really, we need more defined language here in the U.S. in terms of what does it mean to be an acute use of cannabis versus chronic use, the timing of the use, what is frequency, what is, you know, a frequent user versus non. So all these things for us, at least, is language. That seems to be the biggest ask from physicians right now, is to nail down that language.
That's such a good point, because if you can't study something if you don't standardize how things are defined. That's been a problem, actually. I don't know if it has been in chronic pain, but in regional anesthesia, in acute pain, it's been a huge problem.
Yeah, absolutely. I would say, you know, from my end, I think we all know this is the first time in history that a drug has made it to the place of a health-related condition without the science backing it, right? And so we now have this drug that's completely ubiquitously out there. People are using it, and we are trying to play catch-up. And so from a clinical standpoint, we're making guidelines, we're talking about these things because we know that we need to understand this to better take care of people. But on the research end, we really need to just start collecting data. And we lost our big head start in Canada once we made it recreationally legal. So I think for you in the states that are still sitting in the middle, you have this opportunity to potentially still guide how you collect that data before it, you know, it becomes completely recreationally legal. Because once that happens, you really lose your ability to guide how it's being consumed by the public.
Well, that's a good way to end our podcast. Thank you to both of you for joining us and donating your time and your expertise. And I really do think that the Azra community and RAPM readership is better off due to all your hard work. So hats off to you guys. And of course, thanks to all of our listeners. And we'll see you next time.
Thank you.
Thanks so much, Brian.
Thank you for listening to the RAPM Focus podcast. Original music and production are done by Dan Langa. More information can be found at www.danlanga.com. We hope you'll join us in the future for more discussions with authors published in the RAPM Journal, and you can visit us at www.rapm.org.